Case number 21-3836, Laura Hudak versus Elmcroft of Sagamore Hills et al. Argument not to exceed 15 minutes per side. Ms. Tomlinson, you may proceed for the appellants.
Good afternoon. My name is Teresa Tomlinson. I represent the defendants' appellants Elmcroft, and I will be reserving 5 minutes for rebuttal. May it please the court. Today, the court considers the PREP Act, an extraordinary statute for an extraordinary circumstance. Perhaps no other statute, save its mother statute, the Public Health Service Act, has the breadth of unique federal characteristics, such as jurisdictional suit immunity, the rare assignment of a special court, an express exclusive federal jurisdiction provision, a comprehensive exclusive federal cause of action, and the assignment of sovereign status via the designation of a program planner. All of this results in the total usurpation of concurrent jurisdiction and warrants removal. One of the things I hope we're able to address today is the correct scope of this act. The scope of the PREP Act is all claims for loss. It is not limited to the standard of liability, nor could it be limited to any other element of the exclusive federal claim. That is provided by Supreme Court precedent. The additional aspect to the scope of the Act is that the Act specifically provides for the administration of covered countermeasures to be included in that scope. That is something that's been under-recognized, and since at least 2007, the word administration has been defined to include the management and operation of countermeasures, a countermeasure program, and a countermeasure facility. So therefore, this act is not limited to the use of a particular device. It includes the management and operation and the utilization of those devices in that program and in that countermeasure facility, such as Elmcroft.
What are the countermeasures devices exactly here?
Yes, the countermeasure devices are identified in our briefing. There also have been...
If you could just tell me.
Oh, sure, yeah. They're masks, such as N95 masks, KN95 masks, which we all are now, unfortunately, familiar with, thermometers, as well as testing. And even hand sanitizers. And that may sound a little odd to us when we think about countermeasures in the form of H1N1 type vaccines, other flu vaccines, but we need to remember there was no vaccine for COVID-19 until well into a year.
So we were stuck with others. Is there a federal question then, anytime any entity does or does not require the use of a mask?
Well, first of all, you would have federal question jurisdiction if it fell, of course, within the scope of the Act. So if a complaint was lodged that had that dealt with any claim for loss that arose from the administration of a countermeasure, administration or use of a countermeasure, certainly by a program planner, by a covered person, within the context of a countermeasure program and a countermeasure facility.
So any simple, I think your answer is yes to my
Yes, question. It is.
So any simple situation where a person at a nursing home didn't wear a mask, negligently failed to wear a mask, there would be a federal question case.
Yes, there would be a federal question case if there was a claim for loss lodged arising from the administration.
Because the nurse's aide didn't wear a mask.
Did or did not wear a mask.
Okay, and are any courts of appeals lined up to support your position that that constitutes a standard federal question jurisdiction kind of claim?
The courts of appeals who have ruled on this subject matter already have determined that there is express federal jurisdiction if it is the willful misconduct or allegations that can be construed, such as willful misconduct. None have yet held that a claim that sounds in negligence would constitute federal question jurisdiction. So we submit they have it half right, as in the Maglioli case, the circuit that led this discussion, provided that Congress has been explicit in this, that they had provided a plain statutory language which cuts through the dense analysis of having to determine congressional intent. But Maglioli got it wrong with the scope of the act.
But I'm sorry, doesn't the PREP Act create a cause, an express cause of action only for willful misconduct?
Yes, Your Honor, it does.
So why on earth would the negligence claims also be included?
Because preemption, and particularly express federal jurisdiction, is not limited by the scope of the act, and the authority that supports that is Aetna versus Davila, but also Avco Corp. In 1968, provided that Congress has the authority to limit the scope of the action, and that in no way illustrates the scope of the complete preemption or the express preemption being provided by Congress.
Why is it the preemption, express preemption, limited only to willful misconduct?
Because Congress has provided in subsection A1 that the Act has total immunity, suit and liability immunity for, quote, all claims for loss that are caused by, arise from, relate to, or result from the administration of COVID countermeasures in this instance. And so that is the breadth of the Act. There is no other independent right or duty that exists because of the suit immunity particularly and the liability immunity, two kinds of preemption, differing from preemption and conflicting preemption.
But why can't the state court then, so if we conceived of it as a defense, so then you assert your PREP Act defense, and then the state court can dismiss the claim and send the plaintiffs over, I'm sorry, to the to the agency,
that's
the determination, then you would have suit immunity.
That's one critical point, Your Honor. We submit that with suit immunity, it's actually a subject matter jurisdiction. It is not merely an affirmative defense. Suit immunity usually is implied through sovereign immunity, which is judicially created. We have something unique here. We have statutory suit immunity. And as
just for the willful misconduct.
No, Your Honor. We have statutory suit immunity from all claims for loss, period. And so that includes everything. There is no civil action that can be brought because it is suit immunity and liability immunity unless it's one that sounds in willful misconduct. And if that's the case, then it has to be filed in the DDC. And litigants...
But I guess I'm still a little bit confused because even if you're immune from suit, it doesn't mean that you have to come here to federal court so that we could dismiss the case. Let's say you have a good defense. So the PREP Act is going to immunize you from suit. You're asking that we dismiss the case and send you over to the agency rather than having the state court dismiss the case and send you over to the agency. So why can't this, I don't know why it needs to be a federal court that dismisses your case as opposed to a state court.
Because Congress intended that to be the case, and actually it would not be this court. In the provision of a special court, the assignment of a special court under 2284, which is completely extraordinary and very, very rare, Congress has provided, and actually there's circuit authority for this under the NRA WTC case, which has provided that in the rare circumstance when a special court is provided, that is a demonstration by Congress that there is exclusive federal jurisdiction only in that forum, and it is not to reside at all in the state court. And so to answer Your Honor's question...
Does it get you to the willful? I guess I'm still confused with Judge Moore's question.
Well, understandably, a lot of them are, but this is a unique statute. There is no other statute, and I've now been looking for 2 years, that provides the five elements that I set forth previously. And that is because of the immunity.
Has any circuit taken your position?
Excuse me?
Has any circuit taken your position?
I would say the Third Circuit, the Fifth Circuit, the Seventh Circuit has taken our position 50% of the way.
So no one has taken it fully?
No, ma'am. No. But I do think this is the crux of the matter, and I appreciate you getting to it so very quickly. And that is that that when you combine these various elements of suit immunity, which is a threshold jurisdictional matter, that there is nothing that exists in the state court under the Davila case. Two prongs: you have could it exist, and no, there's no independent duty or right whatsoever. Congress took care of that in subsection A1 and subsection A2, which further defines the scope of the act. And then they went on and provided for a special court, saying, we don't want this to get confused whatsoever. It shall not be in the district courts of the United States, nor shall it burden them. It shall be in one court where there is continuity of decision. And then it went on further to say, let us be clear, there will be express federal jurisdiction. Maglioli said that's explicit, as clear as it gets. And then they went on to say, and further, there's going to be an exclusive federal cause of action. And then they further defined it. Now, what Davila says is even in those cases where there are punitive damages, bad faith claims, whatever it may be, and the elements are different, that is not the essence of the scope of the act that provides for the express federal jurisdiction, or should the court choose to imply complete preemption, will constitute or direct complete preemption.
I see that your red light is on.
Yes.
So if you want to save your time.
Yes, I do. Thank you so much.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. Adam Pulver for Plaintiff Appellee Laura Hudak. I think the court can read for itself, obviously, the decisions of its sister circuits. However, I'd strongly disagree with Ms. Thompson's assertion that other courts have even 50% gone that way. Particularly the Fifth Circuit, for example, has now issued two published opinions. And it's true they had said, assuming without deciding that the willful misconduct cause of action is completely preemptive, the claims there were not completely preempted. So I think assuming without deciding if that's the best you can do does not indicate even 50%. And respectfully, I think this court's own precedent actually guides, which is more controlling than other circuits. In Matthews, this court explained why the Price-Anderson Act is not completely preemptive. And the Price-Anderson Act actually has a feature that is the same as the PREP Act here, which is stating that the substantive law of decision in a federal case pursuant to a federal exclusive cause of action is to be derived from the state in which the incident occurred. And that is the same provision as in this statute. And this court just last year said that is different from a complete preemption statute. And the Supreme Court has said it resembles complete preemption, but it's not there. So if we don't have complete preemption, we then need some other exception to the well-pleaded complaint rule. And there is none here. The Price-Anderson Act then has an explicit removal provision saying you can remove state law claims from state court to federal court, and then we'll litigate them under the Price-Anderson Act cause of action. That isn't what Congress did here. Congress could have done that. It did not. And because it did not do that, we don't just infer, because there is an exclusive cause of action. Yes, the statute says there is an exclusive cause of action, but that isn't enough alone to create removal jurisdiction of a state law claim.
Suppose the complaint had only claimed willful misconduct. Would there be complete preemption here?
I don't think there would be complete preemption. I think had the willful misconduct, as that term is used
in
the statute, if there was a claim for PREP Act willful misconduct, now, of course, the label isn't what matters. If what was pled was a federal PREP Act willful misconduct act claim, which we address in our briefs, we say is not pled here, then there would be a federal question, because the willful misconduct claim is a federal question. And therefore, you could remove if it's...
So if it were that, it could be removed, and then what would happen? That case would belong in the DDC, is that it?
Well, I think because of the way the removal statute is written, again, and that's what's different from other removal provisions, is it doesn't say you remove to DDC, so you'd have to rely on the regular old removal statute, which in this case removed to the Northern District of Ohio, and then file in the Northern District of Ohio a motion to transfer, or move to dismiss for lack of jurisdiction, which is an unusual thing where you remove to a federal court because it has jurisdiction but then says it lacks jurisdiction.
And would all your claims then go, so we would remove to, I forget which district court we're in this circuit, Northern District of Ohio, you just said it, but, and then we would transfer and all of the claims would go, or just the willful misconduct claim?
Well, here I think it's a hard hypothetical, because there is no willful misconduct claim under the PREP Act here. And the Fifth Circuit and the Third Circuit and the Seventh Circuit, if we want to talk about all the other circuits, explained why. Willful misconduct is not just, for the PREP Act purposes, isn't a question of just the level of intent. It's a specific kind of intent. It is the intent to commit a wrongful act. And there are lots of specific elements. So it's not just whether it's willful or not. And
so the fact that you labeled the claim willful in your complaint, we shouldn't worry about that?
Correct. And actually, the Third Circuit explicitly says this. It says the words willful and wanton misconduct were present in the complaint in Maglioli. And I believe in the Fifth Circuit, in the Manyweather case, also addressed this, because willfulness is willful, or it's willful or wanton misconduct, I believe, is what is in the complaint. And that is a term of art in Ohio law. And we cite to the Ohio Supreme Court decisions, which have said that is what that means. And so a term of art for Ohio law isn't the same. Ohio can call something whatever it wants. It doesn't make it actually the same as what a federal statute defines the term. And certainly this court deals with this all the time, where a label that a state law uses is not necessarily mapping onto what a federal law is.
So what is the difference between your complaint is reckless, intentional, willful, and wanton misconduct. You're saying that's the state law. And what would be necessary for it to be a PREP Act claim?
So under the PREP Act, there are three elements that it says, hold on one moment. One is that an intent to commit a wrongful act. I lost it in my, too many things tapped. Intentionally to achieve a wrongful purpose. Knowingly, without legal or justification, and in disregard of a known or obvious risk that is so great as to make it highly probable that the harm will outweigh the benefit. And then the statute provides a rule of construction, which is, you know, very unusual, to says, this criterion shall be construed as establishing a standard that is more stringent than a standard of negligence in any form or recklessness. Willful or wanton misconduct under Ohio law maps on to a completely different level.
So use of the word willful is not determinative, because you have to look at the statutory definition, correct?
That's right, Your Honor. And even then, and again, Manyweather, the Fifth Circuit did a lot of assuming even if we had alleged intent to achieve a wrongful purpose, it's supposed to be intent to achieve a wrongful purpose in the administration to or use of a covered countermeasure by an individual. And here there are no allegations. There's mentions of thermometers, N95s. Those aren't in the complaint at all. The fact that Elmcroft may have used some covered countermeasures doesn't change that that's not what this case is about. The case, the plaintiff still gets control when we look at complete preemption. We don't think, well, maybe they could have brought a claim that could have fallen under the PREP Act.
So what is your claim in your complaint that you filed in state court?
So there are two aspects of the claim. The second one, which no one seems to have addressed in the lower court, and so I assume everyone agrees, is that once Mr. Koballa was diagnosed with COVID-19 contracted COVID-19, he did not receive adequate medical care, there were lies to his family members about the medical care he was receiving, and that he was not taken to the hospital quickly.
What's the culpability alleged with that claim?
So the culpability isn't broken out for the different, those two claims. So there's those claims, and there's also the failure to have adequate infection control measures generally. And for all of those claims, there is first just a general negligence claim.
Characterize the claim as negligence or something else.
No, I apologize. So there are two acts and omissions that are alleged to form the basis for the claim.
I think we're ships passing.
Yes. So then there is
what I'm asking you is what you pled in terms of the state of mind with which the defendant acted.
So there is both account for negligence, ordinary negligence, and then reckless, intentional, willful, and wanton misconduct as one. The allegations that support that claim the aforementioned conduct constituted a reckless disregard. And again, recklessness in any form, a reckless disregard is not a...
So just to clarify, you have sort of an umbrella language, reckless, intentional, willful, or wanton, by which we mean reckless.
So the willful or wanton is the subject heading of the count, which is why we say that is not really what matters.
Right. Okay.
And then then later that says whether negligent, reckless, intentional, willful, or wanton in the prayer for relief.
Right. So
the allegation, just because the word appears in the complaint, it's not a magic trigger. Mm-hmm. And again, so I think that this is a situation where the presence of the word doesn't really do much to open the door to federal jurisdiction.
When was your client's decedent diagnosed with COVID? Was it at the nursing home? At the defendant?
I believe it was, but I don't have that information.
Does that make a difference?
I don't think it would make a difference. I think if there was an allegation, and I don't think it would make a difference for jurisdictional purposes, I think for whether the PREP Act applies at all, if there was an allegation that there was something happened because of the administration to or use of a COVID test on Mr. Kobala, I think that would be within the scope of the PREP Act. There wouldn't be federal jurisdiction, but as Judge Larson was before, then I think the state court on remand would dismiss the claim properly as barred by the PREP Act if that's what caused the death. Because the PREP Act does explicitly say it only applies to claims for loss for injuries with a causal relationship to the administration to or use of a covered countermeasure. So that someone was tested for COVID-19 doesn't matter because that's not what caused Mr. Kobala's death.
So your claim is not that it was the failure to wear masks or the failure to test or any of those things that caused the plaintiff's death?
I think it was broader. The allegation in the complaint, and obviously this is at the complaint stage.
Yeah, yeah.
So it was broader that there was a complete lack of infection control policy on a procedure, and I think all the district courts that have looked at this, and the two circuit courts that I've spoken about, the Fifth and the Seventh, this general claim of neglect that you didn't do anything, and just because part of what you didn't do was use covered countermeasures, or is one of the things you could have done, doesn't make the statute apply, because the statute explicitly says administration to or use by an individual of a covered countermeasure.
Yes. Yeah, so. Seems a little bit counterintuitive to say that, like, if the countermeasure is all the employees must wear masks to prevent disease transmission and none of the employees wear masks, intentionally maybe, they're told we don't wear a mask, that's not covered. Is that your claim?
I don't think it's that weird because the purpose of the statute isn't to be a pandemics or should have more immunity statute. It's a specific... We are warning you and to encourage you to use specific devices and countermeasures that are recommended. Mm-hmm. And if something goes wrong because you used the countermeasure.
So it's a failure of the mask. So they wore the masks, but the masks actually made the disease spread more. They were spreaders, not inhibitors.
Correct.
And the masks were bad. The vaccines that weren't yet developed were bad. The tests were bad.
Correct. Okay. So, for example, if for some reason someone applied a mask and they actually had an anaphylactic reaction to something on the mask and that caused them to die, that would be a covered injury.
Yeah.
And it's because, and if you look at the language throughout the statute, so not just, if you look at all the language on the conditions for immunity, the statute says, so this is subsection A3, the immunity only applies if A, the countermeasure was administered or used during the effective period. The countermeasure was administered or used for the category or category of diseases. And that language just doesn't make sense where we're talking about non-use.
But what about if someone wears a mask but has it underneath their nose?
Well, I think the question then goes to the causation. What is the injury that is caused by that administration to or used by a covered countermeasure?
Well, hypothetically, suppose that the person who wears it below the nose has COVID and gives COVID to the nursing home patient.
I think that would be a closer call. I think if you're talking about misuse, I think the problem is then there are all these other conditions on immunity which are hard to apply at the stage we're in now about whether you were following the directions when you were using the covered countermeasure in order to take advantage of the immunity. And this goes to show why this is about immunity. This isn't about jurisdiction.
I wonder if perhaps the some of the language you used in the complaint has not made this, not necessarily ultimately a more difficult case for you, but I mean, listening to what you're really complaining about, you're complaining about a failure to take safety measures that were already being implemented at that time period. But more fundamentally, you're complaining about the fact that the facility just didn't recognize and treat, without knowing whether the decedent had COVID or not, just didn't get medical attention. Whatever they did, it was too little too late, and it was done only when the relatives insisted that their father was in the condition that he needed a hospitalization. And so, I mean, it just seems like this could have been made simpler by just pleading it as necklace as negligent and reckless conduct. And maybe if you wanted to put willfulness in there, but I don't know. But that's the fundamental is that he didn't get the treatment he needed when he needed it.
I see your time has expired, but may I briefly just respond to that?
Respond, please.
I think this just goes to show why you don't look to the individual word willful. That doesn't really matter. And for the first 15 years of this statute, no one thought that this was a complete preemption statute. That's why all these cases came up now. Certainly, if the lack of willful, the word willful in the complaint is dispositive, I think that shows why that actually isn't dispositive, because you look to the nature of
I'm not suggesting that it is
certainly
dispositive. I'm just saying.
Yes, Your Honor.
The conduct sounds more like negligence, gross negligence, recklessness.
I agree, Your Honor. Thank you.
Thank you.
A couple of quick things. The plaintiff has four separate counts that spell out willful misconduct, six separate paragraphs, and the word intentional is in all of those. And so, if we go by the well-pleaded complaint rule alone, then they are in federal court by force of their own hand in drafting this complaint, if indeed we take what we contend is an erroneous and overly narrow construction of what Congress has done. We have to ask, what was Congress doing if they took all this time for quite a comprehensive and extraordinary statute? The more you read it, the more complex you will see it is as you get further into this case. In fact, Maglioli said that the context of the PREP Act is extraordinary and that it is more comprehensive in its express federal jurisdiction than the National Bank Act, than ERISA, and then the LMRA. And I will note that Mr. Pulver stated that this court's authority in Matthews is somehow beneficial to the plaintiff. It most certainly is not. They do talk in there about a borrowing statute and find that it's fairly anemic. Matthews, as contrary to this particular statute, they actually provide for the most narrow of a borrowing statute, and that it cannot be employed whatsoever if it is conflicting with the PREP Act or if it's conflicting with any federal law. I will also correct that Matthews actually provided for removal jurisdiction, not complete jurisdiction, but removal jurisdiction, because Congress has expressly said so. We draw a comparison to that conceptually by saying, though we do not have the word removal in this statute, we have a special court, we have exclusive federal jurisdiction, exclusive cause of action, a comprehensive process under beneficial, and so it is a much stronger statute as far as both express and complete preemption analysis would be. So I think that what the plaintiff is suggesting is to utterly just read all of this out of the statute, particularly the term administration. This is not a pure use. This is not about just whether somebody decided they weren't going to use a mask. This is an amendment to the Public Health Service Act, which is the federal government's power to quarantine and isolate. When this pandemic hit the shores of this country, This country, this federal government, needed in response to have nationwide quarantine and isolation centers for our elderly and most vulnerable citizens. They could not build them fast enough. And the PREP Act, its purpose and its word is to leverage the private sector for the governmental purpose of having these isolation units. That is why the word administration is so incredibly important here. It is the management and the operation of a countermeasure program, isolation program, and countermeasure isolation facility. Elmcroft is a senior living congregate, senior living community, is a member of a class of the only specific designated program planner. No other industry has a specific letter from HHS saying that they are indeed a program planner entitled to the coverage and protections of this act. Now, there is some implication that hospitals and other hospital providers, healthcare providers in that declaration are indeed, but we are the only ones that hold a letter saying such. And so infectious disease controls are critically important to isolation units. The marriage between the Public Health Service Act and the PREP Act should not be ignored. This is an important statute for a national security problem. The Public Health Service Act actually is a militarized more response to this. The PREP Act allows for the access of private resources through licensures, through federal contractors, and through what they call a structure of authorities having jurisdiction, which Congress expressly defined in the definition of program planners and qualified persons, that these federal contractors, that these governmental authorities would be reaching out to those that they too could leverage through our cooperative system of federalism. This is remarkable, and we just can't read out the entirety of this statute. I think it is incomprehensible that this particular complaint with four counts and six paragraphs of intentional willful misconduct somehow doesn't fall under it, that somehow we're going to cut out a lesser standard of liability and allow those to be propagated throughout the nation in the counties of the 50 states of this nation. When what the federal government was doing was seeking to protect its private sector partners that assisted it in doing so. If this court is still in any way considering this business about use or non-use, please look at paragraphs 13 and 14, where specifically the plaintiff alleges that Elmcroft passed or had policies which required testing and thermometers, and bold, all Elmcroft employees to wear masks and gloves. Those are covered countermeasures to take temperatures.
Gone well beyond your...
Excuse me. Sure. I'm sorry. I just thank you. Want to close by saying that it is implausible that Congress intended for this matter of this grave national security interest to be in state courts. They've had a publicly funded administration predicate and a special court. Thank you very much.
Thank you. The case will be submitted.